Hi, folks. You're listening to the free version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. Look, we're able to do this week in, week out for one reason and one reason only, our members. Our members have head over to ROFpodcast.com. They have signed up for the full show. That is three times the amount of content you're getting for free for just literally pennies a week. Well, dimes a week. Nickels? Nickels and dimes. Maybe a quarter. It doesn't matter. It's not that much money. But we need your support to keep on providing even this free show, as well as distributing it on radio stations across the country. Our members are our sole means of generating revenue for this program. So head over to ROFpodcast.com. Thanks so much. Really appreciate it. Enjoy the show. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Today on the show, we'll talk to Bend the Arc CEO Stosh Kotler about their recent demonstration in Washington, D.C. to demand that Congress pass a Clean Dream Act and why the Jewish community can relate to the deportation of undocumented immigrants. Ryan Grimm from The Intercept will tell us why candidates that signed up to fight Donald Trump's presidency must get past the Democratic Party first. Nation contributor Adam Fetterman will join us to explain why most of the National Parks Advisory Board resigned last week. And Heather Digby-Parton from Salon will be here to run down all the big news stories of the week. Don't forget, you can go to ROFpodcast.com and sign up for the free one-hour version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. And if you want the full show without commercials, become a member. That's the best way to support this program. That's ROFpodcast.com. Here to help me run down some of the biggest headlines of the week, Heather Parton from Salon, or as you may know her from her blog, Hullabaloo, Digby. So Heather, the week started off, I guess, wrapping up where the week ended off last week, which was the Democrats, and depending on your perspective, certainly this is mine in some fashion. I'm not sure caved is the right explanation because caved sort of implies that there was some type of cave that existed before it collapsed. And I'm not quite sure there was that much strategy involved in it. But the week began where the government shutdown ended before Monday morning, essentially, where there was a continuing resolution until mid-February, where we will do this again, supposedly. And the federal child health insurance program was funded for 6 years. There were other smaller things. There were cuts to other healthcare programs. There was a provision that was put in that basically said we, as a public and the Congress, no longer have the ability to know where covert money is being spent because the administration can shift this money around without telling anybody. But that's where we were. And I don't know, what was your take on the way that this panned out?
Well, I actually have a fairly, well thought out theory of how this went that kind of goes and flies in the face of what I think most people, how they see it. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but that's just the sense I get. I don't think that the Democrats had planned for a shutdown at all. I think that they had a strategy, which I think went back a ways, where they thought, and I think a lot of this was based upon Lindsey Graham, and I wouldn't be surprised if Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell had winked and nodded at this as well, which is that they had thought that, the only way that you can get the House Freedom Caucus to vote for any kind of immigration bill, pretty much anything, but specifically on immigration, which is just, it is a fundamental first degree issue on the with the base of the Democratic Party. It's the central promise of Donald Trump's campaign. It is what took out Eric Cantor back in 2014. This is a very, very, very fundamental issue to the far right.
To the Republican Party. To the Republican Party.
Yeah. I mean, this is their you know, their raison d'être in many ways today in the far right sector of the Republican Party and among Trump voters. This was what they voted. This was a very, very important promise. So I think what happened
And let me just interject here, too, for some historical context. There has been this dynamic, and you bring up Dave Bratt, who took out Cantor, who was, you know, the number two, I think, most powerful Republican. This dynamic where the Republican base basically bought what the Republican Party had been selling to them for a long time, this anti-immigrant fervor, they've had a tough time shaking this. I mean, 2005, yeah. I think it was, you know, the Bush administration wanted to pass some type of comprehensive immigration reform because Karl Rove, you know, could see the demographic tea leaves, mm-hmm. and they couldn't do it.
And by the way, largely as a result of organizing on the part of people like then Senator Jeff Sessions, that later on when they tried again, I think, what was it in, I can't remember, what was it, 2010? They tried the comprehensive immigration reform when they had the Gang of Eight and all that. Again, that same group organized to tank it in the Senate and in the House. So I'm just putting this out here to say this is a very, very difficult problem for anyone who wants to pass this, Democrat and Republican alike. Okay, there is a group of fanatics in the Republican Party that are anti-immigrant and, frankly, anti-Dreamer. They tanked the Dream Act back in, 2007 originally. And any kind of comprehensive immigration reform now is called amnesty, and they get their base all riled up with it. So this is an important issue to them. What happened was, I think because Donald Trump came into the presidency with, you know, a ton of credibility among those people on this issue. This was something they truly, the base of the Republican Party and the Trump voters truly believe that Donald Trump understands and wants to deliver for them. So when he showed some flexibility on the Dreamers, and Lindsey Graham, by the way, Lindsey Graham, this is his issue. Immigration is one of his, you know, in the military, but the immigration is one of his top issues. He's been working on it for years, and he really is one who's consistently been looking for some kind of a bipartisan compromise, which included finding some way to sort of legalize the Dream Kids over the course of this whole long period. So he has credibility on his side, right, as a Republican who truly wants to make this deal. So he's been cultivating Trump for months. He's been, you know, kissing up to him, telling him he has a great golf swing and whatever, and appealing to what he thought was Trump's better nature on these Dream Kids. And Trump has, you know, he's all over the map as usual. But he has said in the past that he wanted to do something for those kids. Remember, he had the press conference back in February. I love kids. I have kids. We're going to help the kids. Right. You know, he said this. You know, he gets all very sentimental over this. So I think Graham thought that he had pushed Trump in this direction and that he had Trump's, that he could play in the negotiations. He had Trump's ear. He could negotiate on Trump's behalf. So they had that meeting on the Tuesday, remember the televised conference, and Trump says, you know, I'll take the heat, bring me any deal, the bipartisan, I will sign it. We need a bill of love. And everybody, you know, people came out of that meeting. I'm sure that many people were kind of rolling their eyes at Trump. But nonetheless, Lindsey Graham and the other people who were working with him, like Jeff Flake and Cory Gardner, there were other Republicans in the Senate who were working with him, who said, you know, look, you know, we got him. I know he sounds crazy, but, you know, I've been talking to him. We got him. And they went in and made the deal. Then they came back then on the next Thursday, and Trump blew the whole thing up with his shithole comment, right? This was the, you know, the end of the bipartisan deal, and everything fell apart. They were left with Chuck Schumer having to go up to the White House, you know, the following week and have a couple of cheeseburgers and try to, hammer out some kind of a compromise. And by that time, the whole negotiation had fallen apart. So what I think had happened, this is my personal view, is that, you know, I think Graham had convinced people, and like I said, maybe even with a wink and nod by McConnell and Ryan, and Ryan's important here, because if Trump had done this thing, if Graham had gotten Trump to back that compromise and back that negotiation, they were assuming that Trump could bring along his Trump voters. And if he had done that, they could go back to the House and Trump could potentially bring along Mark Meadows and the Freedom Caucus, right, and all these people and say, look, this is me. They trust me on immigration, guys. I can do this. I'll go hold rallies. I'll tell people all about it.
Right.
You know,
I give
whatever.
You the air cover, as it were.
Exactly. I will do that. And I think that Graham and maybe some others thought this was their best chance, because I'm telling you, if Trump doesn't do that, if he will not give those people air cover, they're not going to do it. And even if the Senate, right, comes up with some kind of a deal, the House is not going to do it. They're going to have to go back to them, and that this deal is not going to happen. So it's all about Trump. Trump was the Trump card in this negotiation, and of course, he failed because,
all right, well,
he's an idiot.
Well, all right. So Digby, with that story, let's take a break. When we come back, let's talk about, you know, where's Chuck Schumer in all this, and what do you think the next step is, and what should be our expectations of the Democratic leadership? If you could see this sitting from your place in California, why couldn't Chuck Schumer see this sitting next to Lindsey Graham? We'll be right back. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We're talking to the great Digby. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder, here with Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Heather, in the last segment, we were talking about the government shutdown that lasted only through the weekend. It was resolved by Monday, which, let's just step back for a moment, one of the disadvantages Democrats have in the context of negotiating against a government shutdown is that they actually care about government, that they are sensitive to the functions of government. They are far more concerned about the payroll, the pay that government workers get, because they believe in government, and you cannot run an enterprise in this country without paying people for it if you want it to be a professional enterprise. And most people cannot work for a month or two without getting paid and not find themselves in some type of financial, distress. So there were all these, that's the sort of the generic story there. You describe a scenario where Lindsey Graham, everybody had sort of bought on to the Lindsey Graham plan, which involved, you know, buttering up Donald Trump and getting some type of DACA relief and perhaps even broader immigration reform, as it were. And Lindsey Graham was quite confident that he could do this. He's a man who's never been shy about feeling confident in his own abilities, regardless of how that works out. And you suggest that it's possible that McConnell and Ryan were somewhat on board with this plan, that Schumer was counting on it. So when it doesn't happen, when it becomes clear a week out that Tom Cotton has as much of a seat at this table as Lindsey Graham, and maybe more, and when Donald Trump nods his head, Jeff Sessions and Stephen Miller and the general are there, Kelly, or the former general, Kelly, are there, you know, nodding Donald Trump's head. You know, at what point does Chuck Schumer have to go like, oh, boy, I got to go to plan B? Because as far as I could tell, there was no plan B.
That's right. I don't think there was a plan B. I don't think they had one. And I don't think that Schumer, what do I know? Maybe they had this whole thing, you know, somehow gamed out. But it sure didn't look that way to me. I
but
mean,
can you even, even if they had it gamed out, like what, I mean, can you even guess what that game looks like? Because it seems to me that on Sunday, they settled for what was offered them on Friday.
Yep.
And I don't know why you're going to shut down the government to show that you don't have the ability to sustain that action, right? Like, I'm, you know, it's one thing to bluff, but the worst thing is to, you know, basically say like, hey guys, I know we're going to still play this hand, but I just want to show you there's no way I'm getting the straight flush that I'm pretending I'm getting. And then
right,
you turn your
is.
Cards back.
Here's the
I
hand.
Mean, like, what, you know, this is just, that doesn't even sound like bad planning. That sounds like not an awareness that you need to plan for anything.
Well, that's certainly the impression that I got. I did not get the impression, look, it, you know, shutdowns are really risky, and it's for all the reasons that you mentioned, and also the fact that, you know, the end game here is very difficult to see because, you know, Democrats have a bunch of red state senators that are up for re-election. They were balking. I read that Joe Manchin was threatening to retire if they kept the shutdown going. I mean, there was a lot of cross currents coming at the leadership, Schumer and the rest of the party there, to try and get this thing going. Did they not? I mean, there's a part of me that just cannot believe that anybody would have gone into any negotiation without recognizing the huge risk that Donald Trump was not going to fulfill his part of the bargain. This is who that man is. I mean, that was his business plan. That was his campaign. Everything about him says that he can't be trusted. So why you would even go into this, especially at this late date? I mean, you know, this could have been started a lot earlier, by the way. You know, they let it go through December. Maybe that was, you know, I'm theorizing here. Maybe Graham was saying, hey, you know, I'm working on it. I'm going to get him. You know, don't worry. Just give me over Christmas, and we'll go golfing at Mar-a-Lago together, and I'll nail him down. I don't know. But for whatever reason, they thought that it was a good idea to let that play out, which I think in retrospect was a bad idea, because had they done this earlier, they had the tax cut bill still on the table. They still had a lot of other, you know, other levers that they could have pulled. For some reason, they decided to just kind of go all in on the idea that Donald Trump was going to bring along the wing nuts and it would all come out, you know, would all come out okay.
Yeah,
and of course,
I mean,
it didn't.
No, it didn't at all. And for the life of me, I can't even discern what could possibly be Chuck Schumer's plan for the future, other than like, I'm going to try and take a vacation on when that continuing resolution pops up. All right. Well, listen, Digby, we got to take a break. If you'll join us in the next hour, we got. I want to talk a little bit more about this. We got a lot of other stuff to talk about, of course. Some very strange fever swamp stuff creeping up on the right. But we will get to that in the next hour. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio, and we'll be back in just a moment. Just ahead, potential candidates signing up to fight the Trump agenda are having to get past the Democratic Party first. Ryan Grimm from The Intercept will be here to explain. I'm Sam Seder. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio.
If these walls came crumbling down, it fell so hard to make us lose our faith. From what's left, you'd figure it out and still make lemonade taste like a summer day. Stay beautiful, baby.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder. Candidates across the country are finding themselves at a major disadvantage. Progressive candidates are having to overcome the DCCC's tendencies to support more established, wealthier Democrats. Here to explain why these candidates are having trouble getting through these Washington heavyweights, Ryan Grimm from The Intercept. So, Ryan, this piece that you wrote with Lee Fong for The Intercept, The Dead Enders, what does The Dead Enders refer to?
Well, I mean, the guy who made it famous is Donald Rumsfeld, who said that, you know, these guys that are starting to blow things up in Iraq in 2003 has just a few dead enders. I think he's the one who really popularized that phrase. That's not a, It's not exactly what we mean, but if you take his meaning of it, he meant people who were resisting the kind of revolution that had been carried out by the American government in Iraq. That there were a few people that were just clinging on to power and that they were, it was just a matter of time until they were overcome. And the other meaning that we would ascribe to it would be that you've got all of these candidates who were recruited into the game by people like Barack Obama saying, go get yourself a clipboard, run. And they wind up running into a dead end, which is the Democratic Party.
Okay, so basically we have a story of calls for grassroots candidates across the country, and then what we end up seeing is that none of those grassroots candidates are met with anything but resistance. All right, so give us an example. Just let's talk about your methodology here. What did you do to report this piece out?
So we talked to as many of the different groups who are involved in this as we could. And also you have groups that care about climate, and then you have groups that care about working class candidates, and then you have the legacy Netroots groups like Move On, PCCC, DFA, and then you've got the new kind of Bernie inspired groups like Our Revolution and Justice Democrats. And all of that, there are so many races that are interesting now, and we didn't hit nearly all of them. And then there's real energy at the state legislative level too, and we didn't even touch on that. But so just talk, that allowed us to span a couple dozen districts, finding races where there were people who, very credible organizations were throwing their weight behind and who were kind of new to politics. Or not new to politics, but new to congressional campaigning, and then up against them would be a party figure who may have run last time and lost, or had some other connection to the party, and the party was getting behind them again this time, despite the fact that there was extensive grassroots energy around a new challenger.
All right. Well, so let me ask you this before we get to the pre-2018 type of situation. If we go back to 2016, let's say, or 2014 or 2012, where we did not see this explosion of all these different groups that are coming in that are either ideologically based or are sort of like deeply partisan, but not necessarily associated with the institution of the Democratic Party. Before we get to that, how were candidates, broadly speaking, how were they sort of chosen, right? I mean, because we're saying they're chosen either in a primary process or in almost a pre-primary process. Give us a sense of who the players were prior to this cycle.
Right. I mean, it would depend on the district. I mean, the one way would be that the kind of the party machinery at that district level would basically choose who their person was. And often they would choose them for the interesting reason that they kind of wanted them out of, they were in the way back at home. And so it's much easier to just kind of kick them up to Congress. That happened not infrequently.
Let me just see if I'm clear on that. So there were situations where a local party apparatus would be like, man, this guy is such a gadfly. We have him around on the city council or as a state rep, and he's a real problem. Let's just bump him up to Congress, and that was what was happening.
Your Northern California listeners might remember Lynn Woolsey. That's my understanding of how she became a member of Congress. She was on the she was a county commissioner or some such out there, and the rest of the county commissioners got together and endorsed her to get her out of there. It's a phenomenon that really does exist. It's not all the time, but yeah, it
right.
Certainly happens. Because once you're in Congress, you're a reliable vote for the party, more or less. Whereas you can't really cause a whole lot of trouble back home. You kick somebody up there, and they vote for what Nancy Pelosi tells them to vote for, and end of the story.
Wow. Okay. All right. So that's one scenario where you have a local party apparatus. And hopefully there's been times where people in that local party apparatus say, hey, this person would make a great congressperson. Not, hey, I wish we didn't have to deal with this person, but they're too powerful to actually just boot out. So we're just going to promote them and get credit for promoting them. So where you have, and I imagine that story about the local party apparatus is most common in places that are reliably blue districts around the country. Then you have like purple districts and red districts. What happens in those circumstances?
So you got, so when the DCCC, the party campaign arm, decides to get involved, they look at basically two factors. Do you fit what they consider to be the profile of your district, which, you know, those, that's basically a demographic question. And that's not as important as the next question, which is, how rich are you and how many rich friends do you have and rich associates who can contribute to your campaign? And if the answer is a lot, then that tends to be what you need, because they kind of believe that they can take it from there, that they have a campaign in a box, that this list of consultants will tell you how to run, and that if you have enough money, they'll run enough message-tested television ads, and you'll have a shot of winning. Like, that's kind of the game plan.
Now, Ryan, let me ask you this. So we should say this was the old game plan, and part of your story is the fact that it's still it's the new game plan for the DCCC. That is the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. So what's the theory here? Is that money is so determinant of a candidate's chances of win that is the only metric in which we should decide that this person is worthy of our support? Is that the theory?
That's how some people would certainly put it. Others would say that it is so important. It may not be the only thing, but it is so important that it's the most important thing, and that you can't do it without it. That you still need a few extra things, but you need that. Others would say, no, the only thing DCCC cares about is money, full stop.
What does the DCCC say about that? I mean, will they cop to that perspective?
Their rhetoric has actually changed around that in a positive way. And this time around, they have invested in field work, in grassroots networks. They've invested in some trainings. And they say publicly that they take into account what your grassroots network is when they're kind of evaluating people for whether or not they should get support. And they didn't really say that in the past. And so the fact that they're saying it is the progress. I think, you know, change is hard, and right, there are so many districts out in the country that it's hard to turn this big ship around. And Zephyr Teachout, who law professor who ran in 2016, I thought made a really good point in the story, which was that you can disagree with this or agree with this plan ideologically, but structurally, the bigger problem is they just don't have the talent and the resources to pull it off. The country is too big to be able to accurately predict who's going to be the best candidate in Dayton, Ohio, for the Democratic Party. Who's doing that? A kid sitting in an office in Washington is not going to be able to do that across the country effectively.
Well, now, let's take a break. When we come back, I want to just zero in on this notion of, like, you know, should it be the job of the DCCC to figure out who's going to be the best candidate in the primaries, or should it be a different job that might just sit back and see what comes out of these primaries? We got to take a quick break. I'm talking to Ryan Grimm on his piece in The Intercept called The Dead Enders.
Thank you.
We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now I'm talking with Ryan Grimm from The Intercept about a piece he co-authored with Lee Fong, The Dead Enders. Candidates who signed up to battle Donald Trump must get past the Democratic Party first. So, Ryan, when we broke, we had got to the point where you had mentioned that in your piece, Zephyr Teachout, who ran in New York's 19th district, ended up losing to a longtime Republican politician in New York State, John Faso. This is a potential pickup for the Democrats in 2018. There are six, I believe, or seven candidates who are in this primary for the 19th district. Last time around, the Mercers, well known by now, spent almost $7 million in that race. It's a very important race. It's the district that was more or less the one that Kirsten Gillibrand came from when she was named senator in New York State. So this is an important district. It's got a big mixture of downstate, upstate connection. But so here's the question that I ended the last segment on, and I want to put it towards you based upon that statement by Zephyr Teachout in your piece. Is there a sense that the DCCC should be identifying candidates pre-primary and choosing one that they think should win the primary to go forward? Or is there a competing notion within the DCCC or without the or throughout or outside of the DCCC that what they should be doing is actually just pouring money into the infrastructure in, you know, broadly speaking, in that district, see who rises because of those sort of the grassroots seeds, and then support that person in the general?
So there's a big argument within the DCCC that says that they should intervene in these Democratic primaries because Democratic voters who vote in primaries are far more liberal than the district is, which is just a statement of fact. And so therefore they will pick candidates who are unelectable district wide, which is not a statement of fact. You know, you can't really connect those two things, but you know, to try to make the best case for them, it would be, say, look at what happened to Republicans in, what was it, 2014 or so, when Christine O'Donnell in Delaware, you know, ran a campaign saying that she's not a witch, and that successfully knocked off Mike Castle, a very popular centrist Republican in Delaware, and they lost that seat, and now they're not going to control, you know, Delaware for decades. So that would be kind of the flip of the DCCC's argument for why it's actually smart for them to get involved. But from a tactical
Is there another argument that says, okay, that's true of Christine O'Donnell, but have you seen the big board lately? Like, I mean, right. Yes.
Yeah.
Isn't the point
also, they
here
don't win.
Not one race, it's the net tally of where we
right.
are. But here, let me ask you this. Is there any data? Like you know, like you say, we're talking about hundreds of races across the across the country on some level. But is there any data? I mean, does the DCCC say, like, look, we put this up and we intervened here. We didn't intervene there. These are two communities that are relatively, you know, similar. And we won these or we didn't win those. I mean, is there any attempt to actually do any analysis of the validity of that theory?
I haven't seen any academics do it, and I think it would be interesting to try. But absent that, all you have is anecdotes, and the DCCC can point to some, and then activists can point to others who beat DCCC backed candidates and then went on to win the general elections and have held on to the seat since. So both sides can find some cases that support their theory, but broadly, the activists would say, well, look at what the DCCC has done with the Democratic Party. It's a disaster. They're getting wiped out everywhere. So you have those absolute numbers that don't work in the DCCC's favor.
So the argument from activists is that even if we could show that there's some type of parity or even a slight advantage to the DCCC's theory of intervention,
In the final analysis, it's not working in the bigger picture.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Look, all they have to say is scoreboard.
Right.
ECCC has been trying this for now. There are isolated cases where I think everybody would agree, and particularly because of California's new system, you know, where the top two make it past, regardless of party, it matters if you intervene there. If you have two Republicans on the ballot and you have six really good Democrats on the ballot, the way the numbers shake out and what has happened in the past is that a Republican, more people will vote for a Democrat right. than a Republican, but two Republicans will wind up on the general election ballot. So in a case like that, there's certainly logic in saying, okay, look, Democrats, like, let's just put two or three of you up there.
Right. All right. But so in those other instances, who are the voices of reform? I mean, is it and is what you're seeing in terms of the rhetoric change, is there any indication that that rhetoric is being matched by deed by the DCCC, or is it just too early to tell?
There's a little bit of indication, but not a ton. And we'll see, you know, how it plays out the rest of this campaign too, especially now that there's even more attention on the primaries. So, you know, we'll see. It's a little early to say, but I think they were probably a little stung by the story yesterday, and it might have them rethinking some of it. They have been out there publicly endorsing 18 candidates so far, and in a significant number of those districts, they're activists who are rallying around other candidates. So that it's not a case of, well, I think the DNC is backing Hillary because, look, they scheduled the debates on Sunday night. It's like, no, they put out a press release saying they're backing this person. So, you know, they're doing it very out in the open.
With just 30 seconds left, I mean, because you did cover so many districts here, and everybody, it's a big piece. People should definitely read this to get a sense of what's going on. But are there specific districts that you think will be bellwethers for any changes in what the DCCC is doing?
I think Pennsylvania 16, the one that we led off with, is a big one. This is a Lancaster district, and the candidate there is raising so much money, small dollars, that it shows the DCCC that there are other ways besides running through rich friends to raise hundreds of thousands of dollars, and that maybe the D-Trip should lean into that instead.
That'll be fascinating to see where they come out on that. Ryan Grimm, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate the piece. I know you had to trek through the weather out there and while we did this, so I appreciate
apologies
it.
For that.
Ryan Grimm is The Intercept's D.C. Bureau Chief. He's a contributor to the Young Turks Network and author of the book, This Is Your Country on Drugs, The Secret History of Getting High in America. When we come back, Heather Digby Parton will join us to analyze more news from the past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Check out ROFpodcast.com to support the show.